The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 211, a paper entitled Joseph Smith, William Miller, Ellen G. White, and Mary Baker Eddy, Four American Prophets' Perspectives on Slavery, Race, and Ethnicity by Newell Bringhurst, with a response from Sterling Adams.
Good morning. This is session 211, Joseph Smith, William Miller, Ellen G. White, and Mary Baker Eddy for American Prophets' Perspectives on Slavery, Race, and Ethnicity. Welcome to the Sunstone Symposium. Admission is by ticket. All of you should have your name tag or ticket that should have been purchased at the registration table. Let me announce our speaker and respondent. Newell Bringhurst has presented at Sunstone many times. I've enjoyed his presentations. He teaches history and government at the College of the Sequoias in the San Joaquin Valley in California. He has a BA in history from the University of Utah and a PhD in history from the University of California, Davis. He's the author and co-editor of numerous books, including Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, The Changing Place of Black People Within Mormonism, Fawn McCabe Brody, A Biographer's Life, Black and Mormon, and Excavating Mormon Past, the New Historiography of the Last Half Century. Our respondent is Sterling Adams. Sterling is an attorney who lives in Orem, Utah. He has continuing research and writing interest in the history of Mormon concepts of lineage and race. Related to today's topic, Sterling has a review of the book Black and Mormon, co-authored by Newell Bringhurst, which is published in the latest Journal of Mormon History. And we has that come out now?
What's that?
The latest Journal of Mormon History hasn't come out yet.
It's still pending.
Also, the June issue of BYU Studies included his reviews of David Goldenberg's The Curse of Ham, Race and Slavery in Early Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and Stephen R. Haynes' Noah's Curse, The Biblical Justification of American Slavery. We have a 60-minute session. The presenter will have 30 minutes, the respondent 15, and we'll hopefully have time for comments.
I just want to appreciate you coming out here early morning session. I sort of gasped when they told me I was going to have to come out and do this first thing coming in. I'm staying with the family out in Taylorsville. I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to fight the traffic and everything else. I'm not used to this traffic because I live in Visalia, and Visalia is still reasonably small. I guess it's up to 100,000, but compared to the Salt Lake Wasatch Front, it's considerably small. But I just wanted to put in a plug for a couple of things. I'm program chair for the John Whitmer Historical Association, and my paper today is going to be sort of indicative of what we're doing with our theme at John Whitmer, the larger theme of Joseph Smith and his complex legacy. That's going to be our theme at John Whitmer, and I like to feel that we've put together a pretty good program this year, since I had a lot to do with it. Bill there has helped, and my good friends from the Community of Christ, and I feel in many ways they're really my kindred spirits, and we've put together this program. Our conference is going to be held from the September 29th through October the 2nd in Springfield. And I've got some brochures here that you're welcome to come up and pick up a copy. This has got the registration information. It's got an overview of the program. And one of the things that I think you'll find very unique about our organization this year is that we're going to have the first shot at discussing and critiquing Richard L. Bushman's long-awaited forthcoming biography on Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, which is published by Alfred A. Knopf, which ironically enough was the same publisher who published Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History precisely 50 years earlier. I talk about ironies. You know, I think it was Brent Metcalf mentioned that the Hoffman bombings took place on Nietzsche's birthday. But talk about juxtapositions of events. But anyway, I've probably said more than I should have, but I really want to plug John Whitmer, because I think we've got really an outstanding program, and Jan Shipps, the unsinkable Jan Shipps will be, she's our president, and she'll be giving our presidential address. Springfield, Illinois. Thank you, Bill. Yeah, and the brand new Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum, state of the art. Oh, if you're a Lincoln buff, I mean you're in seventh heaven. And if you're also a devotee of Restoration Mormon history, you're in double seventh heaven. I mean there'll be all of that going on. But let me go ahead and start with my paper. I should say that this is a part of a projected, what I hope will be a book-length study, comparing these four American prophets in terms of not just race, which is going to be the focus of my presentation today, but also I want to explore the issues of ethnicity and gender, because gender obviously figures in, since two of these indigenous American leaders were women. And I feel that race and gender really go together, and that's what I hope to do. So this is kind of a preliminary presentation of that larger study. And let me just go ahead and move forward. Noted American religion historian Sidney E. Eilstrom has characterized Mormonism, along with Seventh-day Adventism and Christian Science, as three large and easily differentiated religious movements that bear the stamp "Made in America." All three have been forced to confront problems of racial discrimination involving African Americans. At the root of such discrimination is the institution of black slavery, which flourished in antebellum America. Confronting slavery were the founding prophets of these three religions, specifically Mormonism's founder Joseph Smith, as well as William Miller and Ellen G. White, the progenitors of Seventh-day Adventism, and also Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science. Joseph Smith both encountered and commented extensively on slavery. Through the pages of the Book of Mormon, Smith clearly condemned human servitude. This work, written from a Nephite perspective, proclaimed that it was against the law of our brethren that there should be any slaves among them. Book of Mormon Nephites refused to enslave less favored dark-skinned Lamanites. Neither do we desire to bring anyone to the yoke of bondage. In fact, the adulterous Lamanites were the ones who practiced slavery and made repeated efforts to enslave the divinely chosen Nephites. Joseph Smith's anxieties concerning African American slavery were also expressed in the Doctrine and Covenants, specifically in his 1832 Revelation and Prophecy on War, received during the South Carolina Nullification Crisis. This revelation, strongly millennialistic and apocalyptic, predicted that numerous wars would shortly come to pass, beginning at the rebellion of South Carolina. In time, the southern states shall be divided against the northern states, and war shall be spread to all nations. Most ominous, black slaves would rise up against their masters, who shall be marshaled and disciplined for war. The Mormon leader expressed anti-slavery sentiments also in a second Doctrine and Covenants revelation, declaring in December 1833, quote, "It is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another." However, within 2 years, Joseph Smith reversed course, embracing a pro-slavery position. In an August 1835 statement, the Mormon leader stated that we, Latter-day Saints, do not believe it right to interfere with bond servants, neither preach the gospel to, nor meddle with, or influence them in the least to become dissatisfied with their situations in this life. 3 months later, in November 1835, Smith addressed a letter to the elders of the church in which he quoted pro-slavery scripture contained in the Old Testament, admonishing, quote, "Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, with not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God." In April 1836, Smith reiterated support for slavery, declaring that we, Latter-day Saints, have no right to interfere with the slaves contrary to the mind and the will of their masters. He then went on to give scriptural legitimacy to his position, quoting from both the Old and the New Testaments. In particular, he cited passages from Genesis sanctioning the holding of the sons of Ham in servitude. And you might ask, well, why did all of this happen? This is it's a good question. This shift from a pro-slavery, from an anti to a pro-slavery position. I feel that it was due to three basic factors. First and foremost were conditions in the slave state of Missouri, where the Saints settled during the period 1831 to 1839. The overwhelming majority of Mormon settlers were from older, more settled, non-slaveholding states in the Northeast and the Midwest, whereas their non-Mormon Missouri neighbors were largely Southern in their background. Thus, these Mormon settlers confronted the institution of black slavery for the first time. The resulting clash of cultures was most vividly illustrated in the forced expulsion of the Saints from Jackson County in August of 1833. Non-Mormon residents of Jackson, in justifying their actions, accused the Saints of, quote, tampering with our slaves. Mormon settlement in neighboring Clay County also proved temporary. By June 1836, the Latter-day Saints were compelled to flee once more further north into Caldwell and Davies counties. Among the reasons cited for the Mormons' expulsion was that they, the Latter-day Saints, are non-slaveholders and opposed to slavery. But there was also a second factor that influenced Smith's willingness to embrace a pro-slavery position. And this was the expansion of Mormon missionary activity into the slaveholding South. Prior to 1835, there was very little missionary work in this region. But in 1836, Smith, anxious to push Mormonism into the slaveholding South, cautioned missionaries not to, quote, not to preach to the slaves, at all to the slaves, until after their masters are converted. By 1840, at least 9 Southern slaveholders had converted to Mormonism, owning between them some 50 black slaves. The earliest known instance of Mormon slaveholding in Missouri was in 1836, when an unnamed Southern convert arrived at Far West with his single black slave. Eventually, nearly 200 Southern states emigrated to the Mormon regions of Northwest Missouri. The total number of slaves owned by and brought to Missouri by these individuals, however, is unknown. But among the known slaveholders was a Levi Taylor, who, along with his wife Anne, owned a total of 9 slaves, 4 males and 5 females. I'm grateful to Mike Riggs for bringing this statistical fact to my attention. He's done a lot of work on the early history, Mormon history, in Missouri. Now, Anne Taylor was the daughter of a well-known 19th century Latter-day Saint, Abraham O. Smoot. You might have heard that name. He himself was also a slaveholder. More noteworthy is the apparent fact that Joseph Smith himself owned a black slave, or at least utilized the services, the domestic services, of an African American during his Missouri sojourn. The Mormon leader, Joseph, was also influenced by a third factor in asserting his pro-slavery position. This was a strong desire to disassociate himself and the church from the extremely unpopular but growing abolitionist movement. Abolitionism was sort of looked like at that time by most Americans, both Northern and Southerners, sort of like the Black Panthers were in the 1960s, as a radical, rabble-rousing group of individuals. So, you know, the Latter-day Saints and Joseph Smith were not unique in that regard. And giving further problem to this issue for the Mormons was the fact that a guy by the name of James J. Alvord, an abolitionist, arrived in Kirtland, Ohio, and organized a chapter of the American Anti-Slavery Society, a chapter that consisted of 86 members. So he attracted a goodly number of people to that abolitionist society, which was right at the center of the Mormon settlement at that time. In reaction, Joseph Smith tried to discount this event, asserting that very few Latter-day Saints were involved. The Mormon leader asserted that Alvord had preached his arguments to, quote, nearly naked walls. But 86 people, that's more than is in this room right now, so the walls don't look very... Well, anyway. Joseph went on to denounce abolitionism in general. He further suggested that the following, that freeing the slaves would do more harm than good. Specifically, he feared that free blacks would, quote, overrun our country and violate the most sacred principles of society, chastity and virtue. By that, of course, he was alluding to, the possible rape and seduction of the specter of miscegenation and intermarriage. That's a code word for that. And so that was the third factor. But such strong pro-slavery feelings notwithstanding, Joseph Smith changed his position yet a third time. Following the Mormon expulsion from Missouri and the settlement of the Saints in Nauvoo beginning in 1839, Smith reverted to an anti-slavery position like that promoted prior to 1835. In 1842, he called for universal liberty in endorsing the activities of anti-slavery advocates. In 1844, he went even further, promoting his anti-slavery views as public policy in his short-lived campaign for President of the United States. He was a self-styled third-party candidate. He was pitted against James K. Polk, who was a Democrat, and Whig Henry Clay. He adopted a platform, which I'm sure most of you have probably heard of, Views on the Government and Policies of the United States. A major part of this platform, a major plank of this platform, was his anti-slavery position, in which he called for the breakdown of slavery and the removal of the shackles from the poor black man. His program was based on compensated emancipation, in which he admonished Southern citizens to petition their respective state legislatures to approve the necessary funding and enabling legislation. The money that would be used to do this would be obtained through the sale of public lands. Smith believed that this program, which was quite well thought out, could bring about the complete elimination of American slavery by 1850. But The assassination of Joseph Smith on the 27th of June, 1844, ended his presidential campaign on a sudden, tragic note. The popularity of Smith's program among the broader American electorate will never be known. In certain respects, his proposals were similar to and reminiscent of earlier proposals made by Thomas Jefferson, Henry Clay, as well as the American Colonization Society. Now, moving away from Joseph Smith, I want to consider these other American religious leaders, two identified with American Adventism, namely William Miller and Ellen G. White, who also made public their views on slavery during this critical period. William Miller, like Joseph Smith Jr., was a New England native born in 1782 in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He lived most of his life in two small villages on the border of Vermont and New York. Like Smith, Miller had limited formal education, initially eking out a living as a poor farmer before joining American forces fighting in the War of 1812. In his religious beliefs, Miller was initially a seeker, first embracing deism and then becoming a Calvinist Baptist, and then was caught up in, thus he was caught up in the religious fervor of the Second Great Awakening. As a result, Miller undertook intense study of the Bible, drawn particularly to its apocalyptic books, especially the Book of Daniel, whereby he became convinced that the advent leading to the end times and the second coming would occur in or about 1843. Miller began lecturing on the advent in 1831, and over the next decade enlisted a following that numbered 50,000 adherents at its peak. As for slavery, Miller initially expressed anti-slavery views during the 1830s. In an 1834 account, he denounced the abolitionists as, quote, fire-scald, visionary, fanatical, treasonous, suicidal, demoralizing, and hot-headed. What else did he like about him? Well, anyway. But after 1840, Miller became more sympathetic to the anti-slavery cause. In making this shift, as you can see, Miller seemed to mirror the behavior of Joseph Smith. Although Miller was labeled a committed anti-slavery man by this time, he and his followers actually avoided involvement, direct involvement, with abolitionism, presenting themselves instead as apolitical apocalyptics, looking toward the millennium and second coming as the only means of abolishing slavery. And so there's where he kind of differed a little bit with Joseph Smith. Swept up by such strong abolitionist fervor, Miller and his followers expected that the 22nd of October, 1844, would be the date that the Advent would commence. Everybody got ready. They were, you know, sold their goods and they gathered and they were expecting all of this to take place. However, this date came and went without incident. And this resulted in the so-called Great Disappointment. And this Great Disappointment, followed by shortly thereafter by Miller's own death, ended the Millerite phase of Adventism. But to the Great Disappointment, some 50,000 people still considered themselves Adventists, divided by a dozen different doctrines. As you can see, there's a little bit of a parallel with what happened in Mormonism, you know, following the death of Joseph Smith. The largest Adventist faction came under the control of a triumvirate of three individuals: Joseph Bates, James White, and his wife Ellen G. White. Ellen G. White assumed Adventist's most crucial role as the movement's seer or prophet, using her visions to confirm, to reinforce, and extend the developing doctrines of the movement. Her role in Adventism clearly paralleled that of Joseph Smith within Mormonism. Ellen Gould Harmon, a native New Englander, was born in Gorham, Maine in 1827. At age 9, Ellen suffered a broken nose and other facial injuries, severely hurt by a heavy stone thrown by an angry classmate. This resulted in extreme physical disfigurement, along with difficulty in breathing and other chronic health problems. These problems compelled young Ellen to suspend her formal education after completing just 3 grades. Psychologically, she became withdrawn and sensitive. She found solace in her religious faith as an adolescent and embraced Adventism. Over time, Ellen White, along with her husband and other Adventist leaders, developed a set of distinctive beliefs and practices which brought cohesion to the Adventist movement. The Adventists promoted as their core doctrine millenarian Adventism, a fundamental belief that the end times were near, but unlike Miller, they declined to set a precise date. They interpreted growing national division over slavery and the coming of the Civil War as clear signs of the times. In this way, they were very much like the Latter-day Saints were in their millenarian beliefs, you know, not setting a precise date. White viewed the struggle over slavery in eschatological terms of good versus evil. Specifically, she viewed the continuing tolerance of African-American slavery as a clear indication of a decaying world. In an 1858 essay entitled The Sins of Babylon, White condemned slavery as an abomination in the eyes of God. Quote, "All heaven beholds with indignation human beings reduced by their fellow men to the lowest depths of degradation." During the Civil War itself, she went on to further declare, quote, "God is punishing this nation for the high crime of slavery." In this, she sort of paralleled some of the things that Abraham Lincoln came to say, you know, during the Civil War. And if you read some of his statements about the divine intervention of divine providence. Even though White and her fellow Adventists were strongly anti-slavery, they refused to vote or participate in the political process. Adventists also refused to fight in the Civil War. White justified such Adventist pacifism by affirming that slavery would not be abolished until the Second Advent. Nevertheless, White encouraged her fellow Adventists to remain steadfast in their anti-slavery views throughout this period. Now I want to turn last to Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science. Even though her movement, the Church of Christ Scientists, was not formally organized as a distinct denomination until 1875, some 10 years after the Civil War and the ending of African-American slavery, Baker's attitudes on slavery are noteworthy in that they influenced ideas and concepts developed within the Christian Science movement. Born in 1821 in Bow, New Hampshire, Mary Morse Baker was almost an exact contemporary of fellow New Englander and church founder Ellen G. White. Like White, Baker as a youth suffered from chronic health problems, specifically spinal and nervous ailments. This made it difficult for her to attend school regularly, thus adversely affecting her formal education. Indeed, Baker, like White, experienced continuing chronic health problems during her entire life. Baker, however, was both resourceful and talented, particularly as a writer. By the age of 12, she was writing published verse. Her father, Mark Baker, was a reasonably prosperous farmer, devout member of the Congregationalist Church, and politically active. Young Mary was exposed to the political views of her father and older brother Albert, both staunch states' rights Democrats. Their views on slavery and abolition influenced young Mary as she came of age. Specifically, Mark and Albert Baker looked upon the abolitionists as disruptors of the Union. So it's kind of interesting, there's this pattern of all of these people being kind of anti-abolitionist during the peak of abolitionist activity. In addition, Mary was directly exposed to the South's peculiar institution as a result of her brief 1843-44 marriage to George Washington Glover and the young couple's short sojourn in North Carolina. Although a native New Englander, Glover had moved to Wilmington and achieved wealth as a building contractor. However, shortly after their arrival in North Carolina, George Glover became gravely ill with yellow fever and died in June 1844. The young couple had been married just 6 months, and Mary was pregnant with the couple's first child. It is unclear whether George Glover owned any slave, African-American slaves. In her own recollections written many years later, Mary asserted that her husband was, quote, considerably wealthy, but much of his property was in slaves, and I declined to sell them at his decease, for I could never believe that a human being was my property. That was her version written many years later, but the factual basis of this assertion after the fact is shaky at best. More certain is that Glover hired slaves for his construction business. I mean, they were hired out on contract from other slaveholders, and there was a lot of that going on in the South during this period. Also questionable is Mary's later claims that she, quote, did all she could to teach and preach abolitionism while living in North Carolina. In fact, Mary, according to the contemporary sources available, remained a loyal states' rights Democrat throughout the 1840s and 1850s. However, by the eve of the American Civil War, Mary Baker's political allegiance shifted dramatically. She joined the fledgling Republican Party. With the outbreak of war in 1861, she became an enthusiastic vocal supporter of Abraham Lincoln and the Union cause. Undoubtedly influencing Mary's change of attitude was the involvement in the Civil War itself, fighting in the Civil War itself, by the two most important men in her life. The first was her second husband, Daniel Patterson, whom she had married in 1853. Patterson was commissioned in 1862 by the governor of New Hampshire to help Northern sympathizers in the South. The second was her son, George Glover Jr., whom she bore from her first marriage. In 1861, young George, at the time just 15 years of age, volunteered to fight in the Union Army. Mary Patterson politically supported the war through her written poems and prose, published in various periodicals. She wrote articles defending liberty and democracy while at the same time excoriating whom she called hydra-headed copperheads. In poetry, she encouraged the enlistment of soldiers, extolling them to sacrifice duty and honor. Following the Civil War, Mary Patterson's major concern was not black slavery per se. Would you hand me the water over there? thank you. Going dry. I come from a somewhat more humid climate, and boy, I feel like I've been dried out ever since I've come to Salt Lake. Following the Civil War, Mary Patterson's major concern was not black slavery per se. Rather, she was concerned about her failing marriage and continuing chronic health problems. Her marriage to the economically unstable and habitually unfaithful Daniel Patterson ended in 1866. For her health problems, she sought various types of treatment, including that provided by Dr. Phineas Parkhurst Quimby. She studied with Quimby and was greatly influenced by his ideas on mental healing. This, in turn, helped provide a foundation for her emerging Christian Science beliefs. Over the following decade, Mary Baker Eddy, as she was now known, for she had married for the third time, Asha Gilbert Eddy, undertook the research and writing for what became Science and Health, Key to the Scriptures, destined to become the foundational work for Christian Science. One scholar has labeled Science and Health one of the most influential religious books ever written by an American, comparable, as you might figure, to the Book of Mormon. Through the pages of Science and Health, first published in 1876, Eddy revealed her strong anti-slavery views, albeit belated, given the complete abolition of African-American slavery 12 years earlier. Quote, "Slavery is not the legitimate state of man. God made men free. The omnipotence of divine justice," she asserted, "was crucial in breaking the despotic fetters and abolishing the whipping posts in the slave market." Eddy went on to link the now-defunct practice of slavery to the current condition of what she described mental slavery, in which all moral beings found themselves in. She characterized this new form of slavery as, quote, "the bondage of sickness, sin, and death. The voice of God demanded that the fetters of sin, sickness, and death be stricken from the human mind, and that its freedom be won, not through warfare, not with the bayonet and blood, but through Christ's divine science. Heal thyself," in other words. The abolition of this mental slavery, she confessed, would be more difficult than the abolition of African-American slavery years earlier. In conclusion, Mary Baker Eddy, along with Ellen G. White, William Miller, and Joseph Smith, as leaders of three major indigenous American religions, were each strongly affected by the existence of black slavery in antebellum America. This despite the fact that all four were native New Englanders, with each coming of age in an environment far removed from the actual practice of slavery or the peculiar institution. The way in which each of these four prophetic leaders responded and attitudes that each developed directly affected policies and practices along with basic theological ideas within all three denominations. Thank you.
Newell's 1975 graduate thesis became his 1981 book, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, The Changing Place of Black People Within Mormonism, one of the two or three most in-depth treatments of that subject. He has written many other articles on the topic, including several historical pieces in the late 70s that he wrote before the 1978 revelation. Most recently, Newell co-edited Black and Mormon, published in 2004, a collection of essays examining the experience of the LDS Church with African Americans. His opening essay in that book, The Missouri Thesis Revisited, is closely related to the paper presented today. It is a detailed review of the literature regarding when the church's racial ban was first initiated. Was it during the church's 1830s stay in Missouri in responses to tension with slaveholding non-Mormons, or was it established later by Brigham Young after Joseph's death? Newell concludes the latter, as do most other scholars. The bulk of Newell's book, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, addresses the timing and context of the initial development of the racial ban. It also contains much of the info in today's paper about Joseph's changing thinking on slavery. New elements in the paper include information regarding Joseph Smith III's reaction to slavery and to the related question of whether or not to fight in the Civil War. And he didn't talk much about Joseph Smith III now. That's in his written paper, right? And then also his analysis of Miller, White, and Eddy and their reaction to slavery is also new. From my perspective, though we're 25 years past the end of the racial ban, discussion of the topic of Mormons and race, and in particular Joseph's view on racial issues, remains timely. Though virtually all Mormons today accept that the priesthood temple ban has been removed and would not be appropriate now, many still accept much of the racial folklore previously used by Mormons to explain the ban. Tales that were spun thousands of years after the scriptures they are based on were written, but long before the advent of the Mormons. That racial folklore includes teachings such as that Cain was cursed with a black skin, as was Ham or Canaan, and that these curses were passed on genetically, that all blacks are descended from Cain or Ham or Canaan or all three, that dark skin is a curse from God, and that dark-skinned persons are inferior to whites. A literal reading of the Bible doesn't support any of these teachings. Instead, they arose from stories spun in Arabic and European cultures where and when it was first economically useful to justify the slavery of black Africans. This racial folklore was transported to and adopted in America along with the slave trade. As an example of these teachings within Mormonism, even today, consider that in March 1835, in the period that we've just learned about from Newell, in concluding his argument that dark skin resulted from rebellion against God, William Phelps asked, "Can or can we not observe in the countenance of almost all nations, except the Gentile, a dark, sallow hue which tells the sons of God that they have fallen or changed from the original beauty and grace of Father Adam?" In 1835, this belief that dark-skinned persons were inferior to whites and had degenerated from pristine white ancestors was common in the U.S., even among scientists and ardent abolitionists. Phelps himself had opposed slavery. The same was true of the other racial folklore I've cited. In antebellum America, this lore was commonly used to justify slavery. It was also commonly accepted by northern abolitionists and preachers. After the war, it was used to justify enforced segregation in the North and South. But while the racial folklore gradually subsided in the U.S. after the Civil War, it had greater staying power within Mormonism. As one example, in 1931, these teachings were officially and repeatedly taught in the church through Joseph Fielding Smith's book of church lessons, The Way to Perfection, which went through at least 18 printings, most recently in 1984. And even more recently, each of the above elements I've cited of racial folklore are claimed to be formal Mormon teachings in Bruce R. McConkie's book, Mormon Doctrine. As one of many examples from that book, in the entry of Races of Man, McConkie preached that, quote, "Racial degeneration resulting in differences in appearance and spiritual aptitude has arisen since the fall. We know the circumstances under which the posterity of Cain and Ham were cursed with what we call Negroid racial characteristics. If we had a full and true history of all races and nations, we would know the origins of all their distinctive characteristics. All these changes from the physical and spiritual perfections of our common parents have been brought about by departure from gospel truths." This preaching, once again, teaching that black skin is a curse and that blacks are inferior, is a close repeat of Phelps' 1835 teaching. McConkie's book was first published in 1958. These teachings were retained in this revised edition in 66. McConkie revised the book again in 1979 after President Kimball's 1978 revelation. But he retained all of these racial teachings. And oddly, in 2005, these teachings are still found in the book's latest printing, available today in your nearest Mormon bookstore. So, why is that? What explains the continuing acceptance and distribution of these anachronistic, factually inaccurate, and spiritually damaging racialist teachings within our community? I suggest that much of the reason is that many Mormons still consider Joseph Smith to be the author of the ban, most simply because they are unaware of the strong evidence to the contrary. As a result, they are more likely to regard the ban as appropriate for its time, and they, like Brigham Young, Joseph Fielding Smith, and Bruce McConkie before them, grasp at speculative justifications for a practice that would otherwise unavoidably contradict fundamental Mormon assumptions about the nature of humans and of God. So, an important function of Newell's paper is to remind us of some of the historical context and teachings of Joseph Smith, data that supports a conclusion that Joseph Smith was quite unlikely to be the author of our previous racial ban. Though Joseph did seem to accept some, but not all, of the racial folklore of his time regarding blacks, he was the voice for dozens of Latter-day scriptures that consistently taught a universal gospel, and his own teachings were universal in scope. As one of many examples, dozens of examples, he taught the saints, God does not love you better or more than others. The soul of one man is as precious as the soul of another. We believe in preaching both to old and young, rich and poor, bond and free. This was contradicted after his death by many non-universal teachings of Brigham Young. Joseph emphasized the importance of an individual's covenant relationship with God. Brigham emphasized the importance of lineage relationships, particularly those of white European saints who were believed to be literal descendants of the Israelites. I suggest that as we as a community better understand this context and the causes of the ban and our related racialist teachings, and along with this better understand why Joseph Smith is quite unlikely to have initiated the ban, it will be easier for us to recognize and understand our previous errors and with new humility repent and improve as a community. Part of this repentance process would seem to require us to effectively reject the spiritually damaging racialist teachings of our past. But how do we do that? It hasn't happened yet. We Mormons have learned much about our own early restoration theology by understanding the surrounding trends of millennialism, primitivism, the covenant theology of the Puritans, etc. Similarly, an understanding of the historical context surrounding slavery can help us better understand both the early and current Mormon response to racial teachings. Newell's paper, and more broadly his book, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, presents data important to understanding the religious and social winds that fanned the flames of our preachings on race. His comparative analysis of contemporary religious leaders broadens our understanding of that social context. So I find Newell's paper today a welcome comparative historical analysis that is valuable in reconsidering Mormon views on racial issues today. For me, the paper also raises some interesting questions. First, Newell mentions that the manner in which each of Miller, Eddy, and White responded to slavery, quote, directly affected policies, practices, along with the basic theological ideas within their denominations. For these leaders, and for Joseph Smith III, it would be interesting to learn whether they accepted racial segregation and whether they opposed miscegenation. Did they accept the era's racial folklore, and did their theology treat blacks differently in any way? And on a related practical basis, were there black members in their churches, and if so, what role did they play? Next, why didn't Joseph Smith's final views on slavery and the views contained in the Book of Mormon have a more lasting impact on his followers? As soon as a year after Joseph's death, Mormon rhetoric had returned to the pro-slavery statements of the 1836 Missouri period. Why were Joseph Smith's anti-slavery views so clearly and quickly repudiated by Brigham Young? Next, did Joseph's changing views on slavery modify his views on racial folklore or affect his theology? Consider that prior to the era of his presidential campaign, Joseph made comments that suggested he considered Negroes to be the descendants of Ham, Canaan, and perhaps even Cain. This seems to show that he accepted to at least some degree, though perhaps only temporarily, the racial folklore common among American Protestants of his era. But in 1844, do we have commentary by Joseph showing whether at that stage he still accepted that folklore? My last question regarding the paper is, did Joseph own a slave? Newell suggested that, and he may have more information than what's in his paper in his footnote, but based on what's there, it seems to me that a claim that Joseph probably owned a slave is unconvincing. But if he did, we ought to be able to determine that from the record, as it seems to be that that would have been something that would have been used later by people in arguing for slavery within Mormonism or trying to justify the racial ban. Those are my comments. I think we have enough time for questions, so I'm going to add a lengthy footnote here. In looking at slavery, abolition, and the anti-abolition movements in the Civil War, Newell has looked at several of the main sociopolitical movements and events that influenced the dialogue within the Mormon community on racial issues. There were many other influences, though few had such impact. Here's a list of a dozen of the dozens of such influences on Mormon teachings on racial issues. I'll begin with British Israelism, the belief that people of the British Isles were largely descended from the Israelites, and the related, mostly secular belief of Anglo-Saxon triumphalism. Next, there's the myth of American exceptionalism, and its accompanying religious accelerant of America as chosen by God and the resulting public policy of Manifest Destiny. There was the bloody land grab of 1848 called the Mexican-American War, in which the invading U.S. Army occupied Mexico City and we stole the northern half of Mexico. There's hypodescent, the American practice of determining the lineage of a child of mixed race ancestry by assigning the child the race of her more socially subordinate parent. Practically speaking, that means in America, a child was almost always defined as black if one of her parents or one of her grandparents was black. Mormons also used that practice in defining someone as black. However, that was the only circumstance in which we used the practice of hypodescent. In other contexts, such as determining if someone were an Israelite or an Ephraimite, we followed the Old Testament practice of patrilineality. I'm going to skip over several items here down to degenerationism, the belief that the primitive tribal peoples of the current age had degenerated in culture and sometimes in form from a pristine white-skinned people who were highly civilized before the Tower of Babel. This was a form of environmentalism fairly common among Christians in the 19th century. There was the acceptance of Lamarckian evolution in the early 1800s. It was the assumptions of this theory that acquired physical characteristics could be passed on genetically to progeny that underpinned the thinking of Phelps, Joseph Fielding Smith, and Bruce R. McConkie in their teaching of racial degeneration and the inferiority of dark-skinned persons. There's the acceptance of Mendelian genetics in the early 1900s, and then the eugenics writings in the middle to late 1800s, and then the formal eugenics movements of the early 1900s. The latter even seemed to have two direct public policy manifestations in Utah. Utah's 1899 marriage law, which made illegal marriage between blacks and whites, and Utah's 1925 forced sterilization law. And then we have the civil rights movements of the 1950s and 60s, the last of this partial list. Those are my comments. Thank you very much, Noel.
I'm hoping I get a copy of all of those comments. I mean, you've got a myriad of very, very good comments, and I'm just going to respond to a couple of them because I want to leave some time for questions from the audience. Why didn't Joseph? One of them I think I want to respond to is why didn't Joseph Smith's anti-slavery views survive his assassination in 1844? And that I just want to spend a couple of minutes answering that. It goes a lot to it deals a lot with Brigham Young, with the difference in the personalities and the outlooks between Joseph Smith and Brigham Young relative to the institution of slavery. Brigham Young, for reasons which I'm still trying to determine precisely, was much more tolerant of slavery and was much more outspoken in his advocacy of the inferiority of black people. And I'm not sure of the reasons for this, but you know, if Joseph Smith had lived, you know, I kind of like to put the hypothetical statement. I know we don't know exactly what he would have done, but I in the part of the paper that I had to cut out, I talk about, in a sense, that the ideas of Joseph Smith, many of the anti-slavery ideas of Joseph Smith, lived through his son Joseph III. I felt bad that if this were John Whitmer, I wouldn't have cut that out. And Bill knows a lot more about that than I do. And Roger Lanius devotes a whole book, actually in two books, where he talks about that. And I think I really sincerely believe that if Joseph Smith Jr. had lived, his position and his attitudes and the direction in which he would have taken the church would have been more alike in that of Joseph III. On the issue of race and slavery, because as you're aware, the RLDS Church never denied blacks the priesthood. In fact, the revelation was handed down by Joseph III in 1865, specifically affirming that blacks be ordained into the and as part of the RLDS Community of Christ doctrine and covenant. So I think it was a difference in personalities between these two leaders. And both were strong, dominant leaders, and they're able to, you know, lead their respective movement, you know, the movement in their the respective times of leadership in the direction they want to lead it. And that's, I'm becoming more and more convinced of that as I look at it in the broader scheme of things. So I guess I'll just answer that one because I think that's the most relevant. But I would like to leave some time for you to come up and ask questions. I urge you to come up here to the microphone since this session is being taped. So anybody who would like to come up.
Thank you for your presentation, Sterling. I really liked your response. Let me play the devil's advocate a little bit and see if I can blame Joseph Smith a little bit more for racist teachings in the church. For one thing, I think it has been argued by Dan Vogel and others that the Book of Mormon can be interpreted, the origin of the Book of Mormon can be interpreted as an expression of the racial fears that whites had seeing these mounds or whatever civilization and saying, the Native Americans who could not have built this, it had to be a white race, and they were destroyed by the Native Americans. Therefore, we have to keep the commandments now, otherwise the Native Americans are going to destroy us, as they destroyed this civilization that is no longer here. As a matter of fact, I think it could be argued that in the 1832 revelation that Noel mentioned, also the same racial fear that if we don't keep the commandments, the blacks, in this case, are going to take over and destroy our civilization. The second thing that I think could be argued to blame a little bit more Joseph Smith would be the Pearl of Great Price. And I'm not sure, you probably know more about this than I do. I believed that B.H. Roberts was actually the first one who made the connection with the scripture in the Pearl of Great Price about Egyptus and all that. But I was wondering if, to what extent do you believe that Joseph Smith was explicitly making racial comments in that scripture?
You make reference to the last part of your question, referring to the Pearl of Great Price and the racial comments. I assume you're referring to both the Book of Abraham and the Book of Moses, or one or the other, both. Because I mean, there are racial racially implied statements that could be that could be derived from both the Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham. From my study of it, from the way that I incorporated into my earlier studies on saints, slaves, and blacks. And, I guess what you want me to comment on, I think to some extent you could look at those writings as providing a foundational basis for, the assertion of the inferiority of darker-skinned people, in that case, blacks, and what, blacks being, the curse of a dark skin. I mean, that strong suggestion in the writings in the Book of Moses. And in the Book of Abraham, of course, there's that notorious or infamous section which came to be used as a scriptural proof text for black priesthood denial, the cursed as pertaining to the priesthood, referring to the descendants of Ham and of Canaan, the seed of Canaan, accursed as pertaining to the in a parenthetical way. I mean, that was but there was no evidence that particular verse was ever used during Joseph Smith's lifetime and as a proof text. In fact, the first direct reference that I've come to it as a scriptural proof text isn't until well into the Brigham Young period. But I mean, those scriptures came to be used in justifying and canonizing or giving a canonical overlay justification to discrimination, to both slavery and the subordinate place of blacks within Mormonism. I should also point out that the Reorganized Church they never accepted the Book of Abraham, although you can find a parallel to the Book of Moses in the inspired version of the RLDS Bible, and that presents another set of issues. Bill, go ahead. You got a question? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're going to answer. Okay.
Let me also just add, you asked, did Joseph share the racial assumptions of his time? So the answer is, to at least some degree, and perhaps a large degree, yes, as did most other Americans. To how much he did, we're not sure. As Newell's pointed out, Brigham Young was different on that, and it's not clear to what extent Joseph accepted some of the racial folklore, and then for a different issue for him in his position as a prophet, to what extent that he taught it. So you're correct that there are some of his teachings, some of the scriptures revealed to him that do carry on some of the racial assumptions of the era. And as Newell mentions, that became a foundation for later discrimination within the community. So I think you're correct in pointing out that, yes, there is responsibility there. But at the same time, I would remind us that during his period, that same manifestation of discrimination wasn't there, certainly not in the same degree. It may have been in some ways. And on the issue of treatment of the American Indian, yes, he shared some of the local the assumptions of the time about Indians, but at the same time, the early Mormons in the 1830s were strong critics of the American public policy of the time, which was essentially kill the Indians or move them to less favorable land to make way for European expansion. The saints were very strong in criticizing that as mistreating one of the Lord's chosen peoples. Of course, as early as 1851, the Mormons were doing the same thing, killing the Indians in Utah County. And then let me just also keep in mind that the Pearl of Great Price didn't become scripture within our community until 1880. And so both it wasn't used as scripture beforehand, and then I don't know the first date as to when it was used on the issue of the racial ban.
I mean, there were references to it in sermons and stuff, but it wasn't canonized until 1879. I think that, or 1880 was when it was actually canonized. Go ahead. Yeah.
I know the United States Senate recently passed a resolution apologizing for their failure to adopt anti-lynching legislation that was proposed in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. My Mormon friends on the faculty at Graceland have often said, you know, I'm so happy that we have a living prophet who did things like the 1978 resolution, or whatever it's called. Do any of you here, anywhere in the audience, know of any time when a prophet or a general authority since 1978 has apologized for the pre-1978 ban?
I think that's your answer.
I'll take that.
Okay, go ahead. You want to go ahead? Yeah.
So Bill's implication is that there should be a formal apology and that there hasn't been. I agree that there hasn't been a formal, definitive policy, which a lot of people think is needed and will be good. I agree with that. At the same time, however, has there been an apology? Has there been an acknowledgement that it was wrong? I think so. It just hasn't been as direct and as firm as I would like. And how has it happened? I think you can look at many statements from various apostles and of President Hinckley that are a universal comment about race is important, lineage is important. I'm saying isn't. Let me enunciate that. Isn't important. What is important is our relationship, etc. And in the context, that can be seen, and I think it's meant as a clarification, a teaching that this is our doctrine today. So that's a correction. It's not as all-encompassing and it's not as formally an apology that perhaps would be more effective in getting rid of the racial folklore that I mentioned.
I would just add, and real quickly, and I guess we have one more question. I would say another form of apology, indirect, would be the acknowledgement by the church, by church leaders, by almost officially, that blacks did indeed hold the priesthood prior to Brigham Young, that they now go along with the position, there were blacks ordained in the early church, but for reasons only known to God or whatever, the priesthood was taken away from them, even though what complicates and muddies that whole issue is the fact that not only Elijah Abel was ordained, but as were at least two of his descendants, his son and his grandson, and that fact is even acknowledged by
the LDS Church, that there was a special status for Elijah Abel, and that further muddies the water. We're passed out of time. I'm sorry. If you have individual questions, and I urge you to, if you're interested in dialoguing further at John Whitmer or ever, I've got these brochures on the John Whitmer meeting. And thanks for your attendance.